Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Living Mythology, I'm proud to bring you Mythic Gaming. First, I'm going to review a game and give you my impressions on it. I will start with these words. Wow. Wow. And again, wow. Did I leave out wow? Board games have greatly evolved since I first started playing them, and I've enjoyed experiencing their evolution. Kiklades, and again, I have no way of knowing how that's pronounced in English. Kiklades, a game by Ludovic Mublanc and Bruno Catala, pushes the envelope and takes us to a whole new level of immersive play. On visuals alone, the objective is simple. Have two metropolises at the end of a game cycle. Getting there is lots of mythic fun, as there are many variables and random elements to complicate your adventure. 2 to 5 players, each representing a powerful maritime mythic Greek city-state, Sparta, Athens, Corinth, Thebes, and Argos, can compete. The action takes place on and in the seas around the Kyklades Islands. And at start, the game is configured differently and may have rule variations depending on how many people are playing. A typical session can last from an hour to an hour and a half. You launch your ships and establish outposts. Then you build. You collect revenue, improving the quality of life in your settlements by establishing a port, fortress, temple, and university will lead you to establishing a metropolis. The Olympians, notably Poseidon, Ares, Zeus, Athena, and Apollo, if available and sufficiently honored, will lend you a hand in their particular sphere of deific influence. Aside from the gods, there are mythological creatures to command or contend with. Space may also work against you, as there are limits to how much you can build on these small islands. Plus, there are other players who will attempt to thwart your well-laid plans and substitute them with their own. Battles can be fought on land and sea. The cards and playing fields are detailed and evocative, which greatly enhances the experience of playing, especially if you're the type of person who invests some imagination into your gameplay. Each player is represented by a different color, red, blue, yellow, green, and tan, which minimizes confusion. The beautiful gaming board is double-sided. If all this weren't enough, Kiklades is expandable to include monuments, titans, and the underworld of Hades. It can also cross over into the Kemet series of board games, which are adventures set in ancient Egypt. As most of my gaming campaigns take place in mythic Greece and Egypt, Kiklades and its expansions will keep us busy for years. Thanks, Ludovic and Bruno. In summary, wow, 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 wow. And now, without further ado, Zach McAtee. Greetings and welcome, Zach. How are you?
Doing well, yourself?
I'm doing well. A little tired today. A lot of running around. But other than that, doing great. Looking forward to working out after the podcast tonight.
Nice.
So what is new and exciting in the game of in the world of gaming today?
Would you want to start with board games, RPGs?
Yeah, let's start with RPGs. I got in the mail today Marvel Multiverse Role-Playing, and although I haven't had a chance to really read it in detail, it seemed very interesting, so I'll share a little bit about that after you share your RPG.
Yeah, so I recently finished reading through the core book for the Root RPG. I had mentioned prior that I'd backed this on Kickstarter and received the alpha rules. I got the physical components about, I think, 2 months or so back, and I finally got the time to sit down and read through it. It's very well designed. It's a very narrative-focused game. As the DM, you almost never roll dice, which is interesting. And it's powered by the apocalypse system, which defines a lot of things as what they call moves. So, for example, one of your moves as a player might be to persuade someone. So persuading is a move. Breaking something is a move, et cetera, et cetera. And each of the different kinds of, like, they're not quite classes, but they're basically classes. They kind of function a little bit differently. They might focus on different aspects. So the thief is obviously going to be better at doing roguish type things, then the arbiter is their version of kind of a paladin type character. They're not really going to be sneaky, you know. One of the really cool things that they do is during player creation, you take your two-page playbook, they call it, which is like your list of your class type feats and options, and one of the sections on there is about your relationships to members of the party. Each different playbook has different possible connections. So with the Arbiter, for example, it might say, one of the members in your group, you are bound to protect them. Who are they and why? And maybe the Ranger has, which is a very antisocial kind of character in this setup. Maybe there's this, someone in the group has betrayed you once. You know, what did they do? And so you have this right from the get-go character building, which is really cool and encourages early role play. And then on top of that, you also have connections with the different factions that are competing in the forest at war. And you can actually levy your reputation with them to get different mechanical benefits. So if you have, let's say, a high reputation amongst the Eerie Dynasty, which is kind of like the bird nobles, you could perhaps go to them and ask, hey, can I lead some of your troops into this clearing? You know, like I've helped you out before, and it's to totally get rid of the other guys, you know, what? And so like you can go and basically requisition forces from them, or at least get a bonus towards doing that. But it's got this nice back and forth where you can earn positive and negative reputation at the same time, because they track it on two separate ends of the spectrum. And the way it works is, let's say you fill in five boxes of positive reputation, then you erase those five and now mark off that you have a plus one towards that faction. Then to get to the plus two, you need to fill in 10 of those boxes. But on the other side of the chart, there's the negative ones. So if I have five positive ones filled in already and I've got that plus one, but at the same time I'm at four out of five of the negative ones and then I hit the fifth one, now I go back to zero. So you can earn both even through the same action, which is an interesting twist that I like a lot. So for example, if you took those soldiers and, okay, maybe that didn't tarnish the reputation of you, but then you took those soldiers and you did something that was like against their best interests, that's going to give you negative points for them. So you have this this nice dichotomy in that aspect.
That sounds like a very interesting game. Have you played it yet?
No, I just finished reading it actually earlier today. I just finished the last chapter, and then there's a second book that I need to read through. For the Kickstarter, I got both in one package, but it's kind of like a supplementary book that adds in extra factions from the board games expansions and some more different rules. So I want to make sure I read through that before I actually try running it.
Very cool. I got in the mail the Marvel multiplayer role-playing game, and it's about the size of a comic book graphic novel. In fact, when it came, I asked my wife if I got mail, and she goes, I think it's about a graphic novel. And basically, it's the playtesting rule book. So unlike most playtests, here you buy in to playtesting the game. And I've had over the years, I think just about every type of role-playing game created for Marvel, from the early TSR, Marvel Super Heroes. We finally started selling them on eBay because, again, I'm never going to play them. And I had too many superhero games. But this one, again, it's playtest rules. They have an introductory scenario. And they have the stats for everyone pictured on the cover. And then you can kind of piece together from how they're explaining how they constructed the player characters, how to create your own character. But these are just a minor subset of the rules. And what they appear to have done is they came up with a new dice rolling system. It's called the 616 system. You use three six-sided dice, and basically 616 is the best roll you can get. So they recommend one of the dice is a different color. So if you get a six on each of the one-color die and a one on the color dice, then miraculous things happen. You can pull off the types of stunts that are in a comic book. But people who want a hero beyond the one that's a picture on the cover might be a little disappointed. There are central archetypes, so you pick a type of archetype, and then there are levels, and the levels contain a certain number of power, and there are backgrounds, and then there's all sorts of powers and abilities. So it seems like the layers of an onion. Layer by layer, you construct your hero, and synergistically, the whole thing works out to create a perfect Marvel hero, more so than any one of the sum of its parts. So unfortunately, they don't have the Olympians in here, but I dug out my old TSR stuff on the Olympians. And then there was a book that came out on the Avengers that used a very similar numbering system. So I'm going to see if the stats are at all relatable. And then from that, I can construct other heroes. And if I can get a few people together to play it, I'll probably play test it by running one of the old TSR campaigns that I never had a chance to run, but always wanted to. So that's what's new with me on the role-playing game Horizon.
Yeah, I would definitely be interested in giving that a try at some point.
Okay, maybe we could do it over Facebook.
Yeah. Or we can see if maybe Tib would be interested too and maybe do like a one-shot.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Okay. That's a deal then. Any card games?
I got to try.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, I got to try one of the older Marvel systems when I went to Origins last year. I can't remember what the name of the system was, but they had it. You were kind of like graded on kind of a range for your abilities. So they'd say, oh, is your strength like marvelous? Is it amazing?
Yes.
And then under each one, it would have a range of red, yellow, and green, which is like your success range on a D100. And it was very interesting. I liked that they kind of had like the degrees of success was really cool. And I think it did a good job of emulating a lot of the characters. I was Spider-Man 2099 because it was a game about like all these different multiversal Spider-Men teaming up. But that was fun, and I would definitely be interested in trying the new system. I've heard it's pretty fun.
Yes, that was the original game, the TSR Marvel game, Marvel Superheroes, and they had those charts. They used the same charts when they did Conan. They did a version of Conan TSR, and they used the same system as they did in Marvel for Conan. The charts were very different, and I found it easier to use the numbers that came with the descriptions rather than descriptions, because I kept forgetting which description was better than the other.
Yeah.
Somebody published an easier version of that. It was also a superhero game. It was, I believe it was called Icon, maybe. It was the same person did Mutants and Masterminds.
Okay.
And he seemed to have done the same thing. He had like ranges, and he used the descriptive words to... for the ranges, but he also showed you how you could just use the numbers without the descriptive words. So I was always thinking of simplifying the Marvel stuff by using that new system, but now Marvel has its own. They were clever in that with the multiverse now that they're playing with, every gaming table is its own multiverse now.
Okay.
With this new system. So your Doctor Strange is your Doctor Strange. He is the Doctor Strange in your private little universe. So that is a good touch.
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
And what type of game are you guys playing? Because you guys play a lot of games.
Right now we've been on a big kick for the Lord of the Rings Living Card Game, which I believe I've mentioned in passing before. So it's, as a refresher for anyone who may not know what it is, a living card game is similar to a trading card game, but different in some major ways. So one of the key aspects of a trading card game is you buy booster packs of random cards, and you don't know what you're getting inside, and then you have to buy a bunch of them to build decks. With a living card game, every single box and expansion has the exact same cards in it. So if you and I went to the store, or went to two different stores, and we both bought one of the adventure packs, we're going to go home with the exact same characters inside that bag. From there, a lot of living card games have like a big community behind them. So this one would have big meetups, which they called fellowships, accordingly. And you would go and just play with other people. I don't think this system did it in particular, but Legends of the Five Rings is a particularly famous living card game that they would actually have the winners of the tournament determine what happened in the storyline. So if maybe this specific clan, that deck ended up winning in the tournament, that deck is going to, or that clan is going to be the focus of like the next story arc, and there's going to be a whole bunch of new cards for them, so on and so forth. So this one in particular deals with you forming a party of heroes and allies to accomplish various quests. So, for example, in the base core box, it comes with three quests that are considered as a whole. The Passage Through Mirkwood is kind of like the overarching quest. The first portion of it has you dealing with spiders and goblins and orcs that are in the forest as you're trying to either A, hunt down a specific spider and kill it, or B, avoid it and get through the forest before it finds you. The way the game works is pretty interesting. A lot of card games tend to have a payment mechanic that's kind of like separate from the rest of the game. So, for example, Magic the Gathering, you play land cards, and you'll have to tap your land cards to get mana to play other cards. In Pokemon, you have energy cards that you attach to the Pokemon to allow them to use attacks. In this one, your energy resource is also your main cards in your deck. So each deck starts with three heroes, which are a lot of the characters that you would recognize from the books and the films. So, for example, I have a deck right now that I just finished building that's Gwaihir, the Eagle Lord, Denethor, the Steward of Gondor, and Maeblung, who's a ranger. And the idea is these heroes start the game on the table. They have usually better stats than most of the other allies you can play. They have unique abilities. But the key thing is that every turn, each one of them generates one resource to spend playing your other cards. So I like that you have to protect your resource management, because if your heroes ever take enough damage, they're destroyed, which means now that hero is no longer generating you any resources either. And that can be a problem because there's four colors or suits, and each card will need to be paid with resources that match its own color. So if I have a purple card, I'm going to have to pay for it from a purple hero. If my purple hero has been defeated, I can no longer play that purple card. So there's a lot of uphill fighting in it. It's well known for being difficult at a bare minimum, because the idea is you're basically pushing Sauron away. You're fighting back against this overarching evil that just is impossible to stand against. So it's not meant to be a walk in the park. The very first quest, when I first got the core box, I failed on that. I can't tell you how many times until I kind of like learned how you're actually supposed to play the game. But I recently got back into it, and I showed it to Tim because I had told Tim about it, but hadn't gotten to play it with him. And he and I both got really into it to the point, like, we went online, we made decks, we ordered all these different sets to get the cards we needed to make the decks. And so I have the first two, what they call cycles, which is like a set of quests that form a story. And once we get our decks put together, me, Tim, Jamie, and our friend Brad are going to sit down and go through all the quests in those cycles and go through them one at a time, like as a story.
Wow. Yes, you talked about this a couple of times, and you described it in much greater detail today. So I'm trying to visualize how it plays out. Would it play out like a role-playing game, or is it more like a card game, or somewhere where one meets the other?
It's kind of in the middle. So the way that it's going to work is there are three different types of decks that you're going to be using when you play. You have your deck, your player deck. You have an encounter deck, which is going to be made up of enemies, locations, and treacheries, which are basically spells or ill effects that resolve as soon as they're revealed. And then there's a third deck that's the quest deck. So at the beginning of the game, you pick a quest, and you say, okay, let's play this quest today. The quest will tell you which enemy decks you need to shuffle together to make the encounter deck. That will then be the various obstacles that pop up while you're attempting to complete the quest. So once you've shuffled and prepared those two decks, you start with your three heroes on the field. You draw a hand of six, and then the way the phases break down are you play cards, then you have to go on a quest. So the idea is one of the three stats that a hero has is their questing power. You need to decide how many of your characters you're devoting to the quest that turn, which means that they will not be able to attack, defend, or be used for anything else. So after you've tapped everyone you want to for the quest, you then look over at the encounter deck staging area to see what cards are already in that area. Instead of questing power, those cards have what they call threat. The idea is that for you to successfully quest, your questing power needs to exceed whatever the total threat is. The problem is that after you look at what's already in that area, you then flip one card from the top of the deck per player. So you don't know for sure what the actual threat total is going to be. So there's this constant guessing game of, oh my God, do I send all my guys to the quest this turn? Do I hold back because I think I'm not going to make it anyway? You know. So after you reveal the cards from the top of the deck and tally up to see if you quested successfully or not. If you did, you'll then put tokens on the quest, and they usually have a number that they need on them for it to be considered explored. So, for example, the first quest in the core book needs 8 quest tokens on it. And then once you do that, that quest is resolved, and then you can move on to the next quest. If you didn't have enough questing power, then what they call your threat goes up. One of the ways you can lose the game is if your threat ever hits 50. That's considered drawing too much attention from Sauron. And so you will start the game with a variable level of it, depending on your deck. But every turn it ticks up by 1 naturally, plus things like this can increase it. So depending on what your deck is geared for, you might be getting lots of threat really quickly or try to stay really low on threat. After you quest, then it moves on to attacking and defending. And so what I really like about it, especially playing multiplayer, it's literally everyone playing against the one deck. So when the four of us played it, we sat there and said, no, I want to take an enemy this turn because I have these guys set up, and if it kills this guy, I actually get a benefit or this kind of thing. And you have to work together as an entire table, almost like this like conclave of different armies. And so I think it was Jamie had a Gondor-focused deck, which was very big on combat. Our friend Brad had one that was based off of Rohan that was also mostly combat. And then Tim was the elves and I was the dwarves. And so it boiled down a lot to that Tim and I would try to stick to the questing as much as possible to free the other two up for attacking. But then we would still have these situations where, oh no, 4 enemies just came out and each one of us could only take one. So now Tim and I have to figure out how we're dealing with these. And so it's got a lot of cool, like I like the communication elements and having to plan together and try to reach a workaround.
And this takes place conversationally during your turn or between your turns or?
Yeah. So generally speaking, the heroes or the players kind of all go at the same time. There is a first player who gets to play cards first during the section of the game where you play cards. But other than that, you do everything kind of simultaneously. So when we're deciding on the questing, we say, okay, it's the questing phase. And then we discuss who's going to send stuff on the quest, how many questing points will each person be putting in, who wants to say, no, I don't want to because I'm worried that an enemy will come out and then I won't be able to deal with it if my guys are tapped, you know. So you sit there during each phase and you say, okay, what's our plan? All right, we have a plan. Good, we're questing. Let's flip over the top cards of the deck, and then it throws everything out the window because, of course, you can't plan for whatever the cards are going to be. Then when it gets to the attacking and defending, it's the same thing. We all simultaneously, starting from the first player, have the option to take one enemy to your board, your private board, so that you're engaged with them. And then after everyone either takes one or passes, you then go around and based off of people's threat levels, each enemy has a threshold that says if any player has X threat, we'll say 35 threat, this enemy will go to that player's area automatically. So you have to constantly communicate that too and be like, oh, my threat's getting really high. Can someone take that guy so that he doesn't come to me? Because he's going to automatically come to me if no one takes him. Yeah, and so it's very conversational.
That sounds like a lot of fun. And so you can get a deck and you can construct your own deck and theme it in a way that you find enjoyable.
Yeah, so they actually just for the first time in the game's history made pre-made decks that you can buy. They recently reprinted the core game, and then right after that, they released the four decks I mentioned, the Gondor, Rohan, Elves, and Dwarves. And so those are pre-made. You can play them right from the box. They also come with a bunch of cards you might want to like customize them with, which is really cool. Additionally, you could always buy whatever boxes and adventure packs you wanted to build the deck of your choice. So the deck that I just finished building is focused very heavily on the eagles, and the eagles in this game have a mechanic where they usually benefit from entering and leaving the battlefield in the same turn. So the eagle hero, who I start with on the table, he only untaps if an eagle enters or leaves. He doesn't untap during the usual untapping phase. So you have to kind of build around the idea of I want to be cycling these guys at least once or twice a turn, so that I can use him multiple times a turn. And then a lot of the eagles will have abilities that fire off when they enter or leave play. So this eagle, when he enters play, can put two quest tokens onto one of the quests. And then when he leaves play, he can do the same thing. So I'm going to play this card that lets me play him for free and then take him right back all in the same turn to put four quest tokens on it. And so like each they call them trait, which is like, you know, like eagles, Gondor, Rohan, hobbits, dwarves, et cetera. They all tend to have kind of a central theme to them that they go with. So the eagles focus on that. The dwarves have a lot of synergy where it's like, oh, if you have 5+ dwarves, do this, blah, blah, blah. Or they have a mechanic called delving where they discard cards from the top of the deck, and certain cards will say, oh, if you discarded this one, gain X, you know, as opposed to playing it normally. But they did a good job of kind of making each one fit their themes a lot, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The hobbits are particularly... Sorry.
Go ahead.
Hobbits are particularly interesting because they start with extremely low health compared to everybody else. But they start with the lowest threat of any other kind of hero. And given the fact that enemies only engage you automatically if your threat is high enough, if you do it right with a hobbit deck, you may not fight an enemy like once for the entire game, depending on the quest.
Wow. So it's kind of like a game like Magic the Gathering, except with a lot more interaction and different mechanics to it. But it's again, primarily a card game.
Yeah, yeah, and that's I would very gladly, you know, sit down. You, me, and Tim could sit together and play a game because, you know, he knows how to play now too. So maybe at some point we could meet up at level one or something, and I could let you see how it works.
That would be fantastic. Now, you also run role-playing game campaigns as well. Are you currently running a campaign like in the Pokemon universe or in any other of the universes that you journey through?
Funnily enough, I just started running a second Pokemon campaign. So my primary one is IRL. So, you know, we meet up in person. It's me and three players. And then I recently started an online one with four players. But the idea is they're both parties are in the same country simultaneously. So what I'm doing is I'm not telling either party where the other one is on the map. But if party one is going to this town and party two is heading there at the end of their session, I just tell Party One that their next session's online, and we have one big like crossover episode where the two parties kind of mix and mingle. To foster role-playing, one thing I had them do was give me a positive, negative, and completely false rumor about each of their characters. And I rolled dice to see who would get which rumor from who and sent them all to the players privately. So maybe player X thinks that player Z is a bandit, but that's false. Or maybe they think they're a bandit and it's true. You know, like there's this whole, I don't know how I feel about you because I've heard rumors of you moving in this world, you know? They also worship different pantheons, which I thought would create, again, some kind of early role-playing friction between the two of them. So the real-life party worships like the classic Norse pantheon, and the online party worships Pokemon themselves. It's kind of a new religion that's happening where some people are saying that certain legendary Pokemon are basically gods. And so like right now the country is kind of in this weird point where like there's no one religion that's kind of the main one. They're kind of reaching a point of possible like religious civil war. But so I thought that would be interesting to have them come from like the two sides of that coin.
That sounds really fascinating. I'm continuing with my Voyage of the Argo. And although we're following the Argo fairly much historically, as was set out in the Argonautica back in antiquity, the players are their own characters, and they're not that familiar with the Greek mythology. So what happens during these encounters often differs wildly from what the characters did in antiquity in the epics. So right now we left the island of the Amazons and we went to the island of the water mysteries and the surrounding islands. And they're almost finished with an adventure there that they had with the children of Arachne. And there's this whole subplot that's been going on not only here but in several of my campaigns for the past decade, I guess, where there's a turbulence in Poseidon's realm. Where he was missing for a space, and Triton controlled the kingdom, and now Triton doesn't want to give it back. So even though he had to, he's been plotting against Poseidon for a very long time, and it took a very long time for it to become apparent what was going on. There was always some mishaps happening at sea, either on the surface or in the depths or in the crevices of the middle sea or in the ocean. But now it's becoming clear that there's a full-scale rebellion going on. Also, Hades' underworld is being attacked by the forces of Anubis. So that's leading to questions as to, you know, what's going on with the Egyptian gods. Is this something Anubis is doing alone, or is it something that, you know, he has the backing of his pantheon? As they go about their quest for the Golden Fleece, there are these larger issues that affect them greatly to answer. And this particular campaign has been going on for a little over a year now.
Nice.
And it looks like it's going to continue on for the rest of the year. We didn't do real time. If we had done real time, they would have stayed in the island of Amazon for around 2 years before they progressed. And the whole Argonaut voyage would have taken around 3.5 years, 4 years. I've done that in the past with a group of people. These are younger kids, and they, their attention is not as great as somebody who's older. So I've sped things up a little bit.
I like the whole pantheon crossing over. That sounds particularly interesting to me.
Yeah, and again, it's unclear. At this point, they just discovered they ran into a bunch of jackal-headed Anubis minions during one of their adventures. And they found some Egyptian artifacts as well that contained magical power. And there were some mummies, and so they're trying to figure out what that means exactly. And it'll take them a while to figure it out.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. And then I have a second campaign that is with a less regular group that is kind of like a prequel, and it focuses on the whole thing with the kingship of Minos, and how he refused to sacrifice the bull from the sea, and how that led to a lot of problems, including the Minotaur and the Labyrinth and so forth. Right now Poseidon is getting his vengeance against the people of Minos, and they have to construct and reconstruct their housing because of the earthquakes and the tidal waves. And so that's still in its very early stages, and everything's pretty unclear. And again, I live and breathe mythology. I've done so for over 60 years. Most people haven't. So I can put all sorts of really subtle things that, will make sense eventually, but they don't make sense, for a short or long while, depending on what helps a story along. So it also ties into this campaign and my last campaign, which was run on Facebook. And we did like 40-something chapters, so it took nearly a year to complete.
Nice.
But this is the only game you can get to do these days, so I try to get as much out of it as I possibly can.
I completely understand that. That's why I started the second Pokemon campaign, is I was... like, look, I don't really get to play, so I might as well run something so that I'm still part of getting to play, you know?
Yes.
So as much as I would like to be playing in a campaign as a player, I was like, at least this way I'm still having fun and just doing more of what I like, even if it's on this side of the screen, you know?
I know exactly how you feel. And again, letting go of things is kind of hard. I had worked, this game came out for the video games called the Dragon Age. And
okay.
Dragon Age grew to include many games in a series of games that were connected, and they came out with a movie, and they came out with books, and they came out with all sorts of supplemental material. So, and they even came out with an RPG. So slowly I gathered all that together, I studied it, and I was going to do a home game with, people who weren't kids, basically. Have it set in that world, where it would be kind of like a PG-13 R-rated world, just like the Dragon Age games were. And I gotten like everything, strategy guides even, which served as like Dungeon Master guides, and it worked out this whole story. And because of the video games, they could wander off and experience certain things in sequence on their own with other characters. And then because the video games don't always play out the same way either, whatever they did in the video games, I'd be able to include it as something that happened actually in the big game. I spent a lot of time on that, but again, it never happened. So I put all my Dragon Age stuff up for eBay. Let somebody else enjoy it, because it's right now just sitting there in a plastic box. So,
yeah, I am all too familiar with that feeling. And that's especially because in the friends, I'm generally the only person who will run stuff.
Me
so
too.
It's the One Ring system, which I mentioned to you many times. You know, that was my dream system to be a player. And so I had all the books, but I was like, I don't want to run it. I want to play in it.
Right.
So I'm glad that I finally am getting to do that. I joined an online game of that last, I think August we started up. So we're getting close to a year, which is nice.
I'm glad you got a chance to play. I looking back on, and I found out about gaming when it first started back in the mid 70s. The way it was brought to my attention is some kids in high school, because I was in high school at the time, said, "Hey, you want to play this game? It's called like Dungeons and Dragons." And I said, "That sounds great. What's it about?" And they said, "Oh, you calculate statistics," and that did not sound like a fantasy game I wanted to play. So I passed on it.
Yeah.
And then I found a copy of the book, and I wasn't that enamored initially of Dungeons and Dragons, because it was basically you go underground, there are rooms, there are all sorts of monsters that don't belong together living down there, and each one of them has loot. And you basically went around, and there were traps and things. It came later. There was a system called Tunnels and Trolls. I guess the second big role-playing game system. And they solved the problem of what do you do if you don't know anybody who wants to fantasy role play? And they had these books, solitaire dungeons or solo dungeons, so you could play, you know, by yourself. And then they also published adventures. It was a lot simpler than Dungeons & Dragons. Like I could teach someone an abbreviated version of the game in minutes as opposed to the days it took to teach somebody how to play Dungeons & Dragons. So although I was kept up with Dungeons & Dragons, I always got the books and, you know, rated it for material because they had really great content. I've always used other systems, and sometimes even the really simple systems, they work to keep the story moving a lot better than some of the more complex and known systems. And then I developed one for kids in the library. The simplicity itself, and a lot of adults like it too, it just keeps the story moving, and it tells you what happens really fast. It doesn't require, you know, anything really. It's just, okay, you need to determine if something succeeded, roll the dice, fine, okay, move forward, or no, that didn't happen, depending on what they're all, this happened, you know, okay.
That's the system that I designed or have been designing, because, you know, it's a work in progress, obviously. I function on a very similar principle where I wanted this to be something easy to teach people who weren't familiar with RPGs. I wanted this to be something that you could say to, like, your family or friends, you know, be like, hey, we're just hanging out and doing nothing. Do you guys want to try this out? And, you know, I can teach it to you in, like, 5 minutes. And, you know, it's, again, built similarly on always moving forward. So even failures give you, like, benefits usually, and it's never hard and fast. It's very low stakes. It's like a whimsical comedy. So failing on a roll isn't going to make your character risk dying. It's going to make maybe your character, you know, get injured possibly, but you're playing a spirit possessing either a human or an animal. So if the body gets too injured, then you just hop into a different host. And what happens is that doesn't take you out of the mission. It just adds to, like, your grade for your mission when you come back to home office. They're like, oh, well, I see that you damaged several people. So, you know, you get a lower score than if you had not damaged people, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, in my the role-playing game with the Argonauts, a few people have died, but they're ghosts now. So I developed very simple, again, very just really simple rules in terms of how much you can affect as a ghost the world around you, and how visible you can be. So they have to make decisions based on that, and then the dice roll determine if they were solid or visible, or both solid and visible, and that's all it needed to keep that whole thing going. So some characters welcome the death of their original character because now as a ghost, they can do really cool things. So we have a few ghosts playing in the game.
That's cool, having that variety in the party.
Yeah, and the good thing about running something like that's mythological is I've run the story so many times over the years that we've had Argonaut expeditions where most of the crew was Egyptians, and we've had Argonaut expeditions where most of the crew were werewolves from Arcadia. So you never know who's going to wind up on Argo. So each expedition is slightly different. And, of course, it's the same cast of characters. You know, Jason's there, Hercules is there, Atalanta's there, Castor and Pollux, Orpheus, you know, Asclepius, you know, sometimes Theseus, sometimes Odysseus. You know, the same cast of characters is there. There are 50 Argonauts, and you never get 50 people at a gaming table. You know, it's most like a handful or a dozen. So, you know, there's always plenty of room for whatever Argonauts they devise, and it's always a lot of fun. And sometimes I borrow from the stories of Argonaut expeditions past, you know, and refer to them and connect them. So this whole big story's built up over a couple of decades. And I've talked to other DMs. They've done the same thing with their, like, campaigns. They tie them together in weird ways or, you know, do you do that in your campaigns too? I think we talked about
the Pokemon campaigns have all been set in the same universe. So the first campaign after that one ended, when we started the second one, it was 20 years later. So then the player characters that had been in that original campaign were kind of like mentors to this new group. They were NPCs. So like the one of them had been training to become a Pokemon professor. So he was the professor that gave the new crew their Pokedexes and set them on their journey. And so it was cool seeing like that stuff hold over. The current campaign is set several hundred years after that one, because the second campaign never got played to completion because people started like moving across the country. So I ran with that. I said, okay, so they didn't stop the bad guys, you know, and that became canon in my universe. And I used that to kind of flesh out what happened and come up with my own country based off of that. So I've worked that mythology throughout. There's been, there's always recurring motifs and characters. So it's a running joke that there will always be a Farmer Greg somewhere in one of my Pokemon games. There has to be a Farmer Greg he's a really, really overbearing farmer guy who really, he's pushy with selling you stuff and everything. Like, it was based off of a friend of mine during the first campaign. And so he shows up in every one of the campaigns. But sometimes his name changes to be like, you know, oh, it's Farmer Gregor or whatever, you know. So it changes to fit the time period a little bit.
That is so cool. I do that with a Busiris. He's a very obscure Egyptian character that tried to sacrifice Hercules when Hercules was in Egypt. I think it was one of his quests where he's like wandering around looking for something. But anyway, it's one of his later quests. I don't remember exactly which one. But I made Busiris into like one of the strongest supervillains in Greek mythology. He'll always pop up in my campaign, either behind the scenes manipulating or outright. The characters get to know him, all like hate him, and he's like Dracula though, like a Christopher Lee Dracula. They think they finally get him, and he'll pop up again sometime later. So I used to have, when I did like outer space things more. Do you remember the show ALF?
I never saw it, but I know of it through like pop culture.
He was a Milmackian, so the major bad guy in the science fiction game that ran on for years and years and years, and I bring back occasionally, is a Milmackian with like a high technology ship, and he has on his crew like aliens from a lot of different universes. So he has like Wookiees, he has Daleks from Doctor Who. And you know, so forth. There's just an odd mixture of pop cultures, aliens, you know, some of the more less central ones. Superior firepower on his vessel. So there too, it always causes phenomenal damage. They wind up hating him, and they finally destroyed him. I remember the first time they destroyed him, and then he winds up coming back later as a herald of Galactus. But player characters need somebody like that. They relish the interactions. Yeah. Yeah. So
what I did for this Pokemon. Oh, sorry. You go.
Go ahead.
So what I did for this Pokemon campaign is, after each player designed their character and, you know, picked what they were like, oh, I'm hoping to be like these kinds of classes, and this is the Pokemon I want to start with. I sat down and came up with rivals for each and every one of the player characters that maybe they're diametrically opposed through their morals or just their background, how they treat Pokemon, but they're somehow against something that the players stand for. And each one is custom made to kind of have classes that I think are a good complement to the players, mm-hmm. and their team is going to grow as the party members does. So like, as maybe if Jamie were to meet her rival the first time and they've only got one Pokemon, and then the next time they meet the rival, now the rival has a couple more to kind of make up for weaknesses against Jamie's party, you know, stuff like that. And that they do that a lot in the video games, where your rival typically has at least one Pokemon that's particularly strong against whatever your first Pokemon was. So I like that idea and like ran with it. And the whole idea is I wanted the cast of recurring characters that they weren't quite villains, but they weren't quite allies, and they can kind of go either way. So I would say maybe only one or two of the rival class characters I've made are what I would call like evil or bad. The rest of them are either anti-heroic, neutral, or heroic in a different way. And I kind of put them in to see, can the players persuade them to become allies? Because if they can, these other characters have access to classes and feats that no one in the parties took. So if no one in the party can, say, make custom Pokeballs, but there's this one rival that can, you know, can they perhaps get some kind of relationship where they can pay him to do that for them? Can they have him kind of fill that gap in the party with that NPC they meet every so often? So I'm excited to see how that will continue to develop as the campaigns both move forward.
We think alike. I tell everyone when they first start playing in my games that you never have to, if you choose never to use violence, you can still get through the game. And I also avoid making any antagonist they meet evil. Different, yes, you know, based on a different set of principles, having a different set of priorities, viewing the world in a different way. They do that, but they're not, you know, good or evil. You know, they don't embrace, evil. They're like people of a different sort, you know, so like the children of Arachne, they don't consider themselves evil. They're just spider people. And they have a definite grievance with the Olympians. You know, Arachne was turned into a spider and doomed her children, you know, to live the way that they live. So they have a beef with the gods that everybody else follows. But what they do when they encounter the children of Arachne, you know, they're individuals. So if they handle it in a friendly, you know, helpful way, they make friends with them. If not, they make enemies of them.
Yeah.
So I try to avoid having that, the strict lines of what's good and what's evil. And many times, like they'll play like murder hobos, you know. And I'll make it very clear to the reaction of the NPCs that, they're murdering people, you know, for who haven't done anything, you know. So that's a whole other dimension to the game.
And that's we just had a session this past Saturday where. One of the players wasn't able to make it, so they didn't want to move forward to like the next big story thing. So they were like, "Hey, is there anything to do in town? Anyone who needs help?" It's a big farming and pastoral area. So there was a farmer who was having some issues on his field. They went over and visited him, and he pretty much only grew like staple grains and vegetables and stuff like that, and flowers. He didn't have any cattle or anything like that. Like, he didn't have any Pokemon on his farm. He wasn't very trusting of Pokemon. He didn't like to be near them. But he noticed that for some reason, something's been digging up his sunflower patch that he's been trying to grow for the past, you know, few months since the season started. And every time he does it, something comes by and digs it up when he's not there. And he's the only one who works on his farm, so he can't just take a day off to sit and watch the sunflower patch. So they were like, "Oh, well, we can help you out." So they managed to kind of get some seeds and lay a little bait. They hid, waited, and saw a few, they're called Torchic. It's like a small orange, like chicken, like a baby chicken type thing. And so there was a bunch of them. They came sneaking in through the different fields, and then they took a bunch of the seed, but then they piled the rest of it up on leaves and started dragging it away. So they managed to follow at a distance. They eventually discovered that they were going inside of this small tunnel into a nearby hill. So they snuck in after them, and they see that they had brought the seeds to these grass-type Pokemon that were inside this hill, in this hollow. And they're called Sunkern. They're kind of like a small bud of a plant, and the idea is they don't have limbs. They're just kind of a bud with a face, but then when they evolve, they have arms and legs. And so they seemed to be bringing the seeds to them, and they were pecking away at the ceiling. And so they didn't know quite what to do, and then they got noticed, accidentally startled them further when trying to calm them down, because they rolled very low on their attempts to calm them down. And so then they started to fight with them, and the one player was like refusing to fight them, and just every turn kept trying to convince them to, you know, that they weren't there to hurt them or anything. And eventually that player convinced one of them to stop attacking, and the little Sun Current Pokemon had started to get really distressed by all the combat, and their crying was getting so loud that the whole hollow was shaking and was threatening to collapse. So that one that they calmed down goes over to try and stop them from freaking out. And eventually, once they calm down the rest of the Torchic, they work together with them to calm the Sun Current down. And so then they slowly started to, they looked around and like pieced it together. And the Sun Current, they all shared the same like roots, because they, you know, they were kind of like budded from the same plant basically. Which normally isn't a problem, because they can hop around, they can move as a train. But a rock had fallen onto their roots, so they were pinned in that location. And that's why the Torchic were stealing the seed to feed them and trying to peck a hole through the roof to get them sunlight, because usually they photosynthesize. So then they worked together to get rid of the boulder and safely escort the Sun Current outside. And they went over to the sunflower field and put their roots down there. And then their roots being there actually helped accelerate the growth of the regular sunflowers in that patch. So then they went to the farmer, and, you know, they're like, I know that you asked us to kind of get rid of what was causing this, but they, you know, they explained what they'd found out, and they took him over to look at the patch and see how, you know, helpful the Pokemon were. And they ended up convincing him to let the Pokemon stay and like changing his opinion on them. And so I always like when they try to look at it as not just everything's a nail, you know, like that's the way I always tell them. I say, okay, this is a game where you have magical pets. So really do not limit yourself to what you think you can do. Like, feel free to ask me questions like, can I do this? Because the answer is probably going to be either yes, but, or yes, and, you know, like,
wow. I just looked at the clock. It's already a couple of minutes till the end of the program. I enjoyed this very much, and I want to do it again. Maybe we can create a show and invite other DMs, you know, because, again, we never get to play. So maybe we have like a DM conversation. I really, really, really enjoyed this, and I think it's the longest we've ever spoken after all the time we've been doing the podcast. Thank you so very much. This was a very special thing. How can people contact you?
You can always find me on Facebook under Zach McAtee, or send me an email at mrmunnin@gmail.com.
Thank you very much. And what is your availability? What are best days to do this? Like any particular day of the week?
Wednesdays is usually our board game nights, and then Fridays we usually try to do movies. Monday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays I'm fairly flexible.
Okay, we will continue through PM and email, and we'll come up with something. But I really enjoyed this, and I wanted to continue. And again, we can invite other DMs. We can invite game designers, and, you know, we can have fun with it. And we'll still do Mythic Gaming, because that's finally developing into like a format thing where we cover a lot in an episode. I like having you there and the occasion. Anyway, they're going to cut us off soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
I look forward to the next time. And thanks to everybody who tuned in. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Zach.
Yep. Have a great night.
You too.